If I bleed tonight, if I am sad tonight, I don't have a job to find. And if I work tonight, if I'm so tired tonight, I'll fall asleep when I'm home, when I'm home. Hey everybody, and welcome to a brand new episode of the Power Slam podcast here at Inside the Ropes. My name is Kenny McIntosh, joined as always by Finn Martin. And Finn, we thought that lockdown and COVID would bring us less wrestling news, but there just seems to be more each and every single week.
Each and every week. You know, a WWE cliche. Why is it each and every? Why can it not just be? Why do we need each and every? Every is superfluous, Kenny. That out at the start. It's just each week.
Well, I mean, you know, if you're going to go down that rabbit hole, why in 2009 did we have WrestleMania 25th anniversary? It wasn't. It was WrestleMania 25. 26 was the 25th anniversary.
No more pedantry. The pedantry's over. That's me. Just I've got my pedantry. I've got it out of my system now. So I'm doing really well. Kenny, how are you doing this week?
I'm good. There's been a bee or a wasp in my room for the last half hour that I've been trying to lure out of the window, but the bee or the wasp has not taken the bait. So that's been my day so far.
It could well enhance the podcast.
Yeah, well, the bee will probably make more sense than we would. But then I actually just got a copy through of the new Andre the Giant book, The Eighth Wonder of the World by Bertrand Hébert and Pat Laprade. So I'm looking forward to reading that this week and seeing how that story goes. Because Andre's a pretty fascinating guy. So I'm looking forward to seeing reading his story, really, and reading more than just the kind of WWF years.
Yeah, I mean, I know he'd been working on that book for a long time. I know it'd been released maybe 6-7 weeks ago. It's been out a little while, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but so I am, because I'm going to be doing an interview with the author soon, and I'd asked for a cheeky wee copy, you know. I'm weird. I can't really read. Well, you know this. I just can't read ebooks. I just can't do it. My brain can't. I need the physical copy. Yeah. So now that I have it, that'll be me. That'll be the rest of my week getting through that.
He came over in 2018, didn't he? We met him in 2018.
Yeah. He was at MediaCon with Pat Patterson. He was representing Pat. So, great guy. And
really nice guy.
So, I mean, there's a lot to talk about. I guess the first thing we should bring up is something that happened after we'd recorded last week, but before Backlash, which was that Paul Heyman has been let go from the job as executive director of programming or whatever on Raw, and he's now purely a talent again. What did you make when you heard the news? You know, I mean, I guess inevitably we thought that it wouldn't last, because, you know, Heyman's very strong-minded about what he wants. Vince is very strong-minded about what he wants. So a clash was probably inevitable. But do you think, did it last longer than you thought it would? Was it shorter than you thought it would? How did you take the news?
I think, did it last about 11 months? August he started, wasn't it? Because I remember, we vividly remember that very first episode, because it quite literally began with a bang, didn't it? With the, was it Braun Strowman smashing the Titantron down, or the big screen?
Yeah. Last July, I think, so 11 months.
11 months. So, I mean, he lasted longer than Eric Bischoff, so he did a hell of a lot better than Eric did. I don't know, I mean, when I first heard it, I thought, oh, is this a storyline? Are you going to work this into the script? And it's like, obviously it isn't. And to me, I thought that Heyman would have lasted longer, because he's not that guy that he was in the 2000s anymore. He's somebody that knows the score there. He knew the score back then, but he certainly knew the score when he went back and took the job last year. So to me, I would have thought that he would have, you know, been more compliant than he was back in the 2000s, when, you know, his run there as a writer famously ended in tears numerous times. At one point, he was posted to OVW, wasn't he? Remember that? He ended up there in 2005, I believe it was.
Yeah.
That was right. CM Punk was brought in and then told that he didn't know how to wrestle and sent to developmental. And I know Heyman was there at that point. And then he received another reprieve and was brought back in 2006 when they decided to make ECW a, you know, full-time third brand. So, you know, jumped to 2019. I think it was 2012 he came back, wasn't he, as Brock Lesnar's manager.
Yeah, because there was that famous segment where, because Brock was on his own for a month, yeah. And then there was a contract signing with John Laurinaitis and Cena, and it was so bad that they basically called Heyman and said all is forgiven.
That's right, yeah. So, which is often the way it goes, you know, in WWF / WWE. I mean, who can forget King of the Ring 1994 with Jim Ross being brought back? You know, after the famous King of the Ring 1994 commentary performance from Art Donovan, I believe it was, Kenny.
How much does he weigh? my favorite bit from that is when Lex Luger comes out, and Luger comes out. He's got his white T-shirt on with the Made in the USA and little USA flag thing. And yeah, I can't remember who was in the ring, but there was a match going on, and Luger was in the aisle, and Monsoon and Savage were put across. You know, there's Lex Luger, Mr. USA, Made in the USA. He's coming out to check out the action. And Art Donovan, right after, just goes, "Who's the guy in the flag?"
Lex hadn't quite crossed over in the way Hulk Hogan had a decade earlier.
If you've never watched it, everybody, like, I can't recommend it enough, because it's Gorilla Monsoon and Randy Savage are slowly broken down over 2 hours and 45 minutes with Art Barr, because Art Donovan. And Art Donovan, you know, he's there, because was he like a football player, yeah, back in the day?
Yes, I believe he was, yeah.
And he's like an old guy at this point, like in his 70s or something. He's there because I think it was Baltimore. He was like a local Baltimore legend. And as the show goes on, he just isn't getting it. He isn't getting anything about it. He doesn't understand it. Keeps asking questions. Keeps asking how much everybody weighs. And it gets to a point where Gorilla Monsoon, who usually has the patience of a saint, just starts ignoring him. It's beautiful to watch.
That's right, yeah. But I mean, getting back to Heyman, no, I thought he would have been more compliant. I thought he would have found a way to make it work for him. He would have, you know, he's a very good manipulator, as we all know. I don't think Heyman would object to me describing him as that. He's somebody who knows how to go along to get along. Maybe he just had enough, Kenny. You know, I mean, it is a demanding job, as we know. And maybe at this point in his life, he just thought, you know what? I don't want to do those hours anymore, you know, and he just did something that he knew would result in his dismissal, or, you know, he requested that he go, or it was a mutual thing. I'm sure more details will emerge over the next few weeks. But I mean, maybe there was a bit of that as well, that he just thought, you know what, I don't need the money that badly. I'm still very well paid as an on-screen talent when Lesnar's there. I just don't need this in my life anymore. I mean, maybe there's a huge element of that, because it is absolutely exhausting doing that job. There's no doubt about it. And dealing with the politics and, you know, the clash of egos and, you know, all the different things you've got to negotiate to get through the working week. Or maybe you just thought, you know what, a lot of the things that I want to do are just not getting through. They're being filtered out by McMahon, and I just feel completely impotent. So what is the point of me doing this job? So I don't know. I mean, I kind of thought that he was somebody that would last longer than that, given where he is now, and that he understands that in order to be a person who works immediately under Vince McMahon, you've got to do Vince McMahon's bidding, you know, 90% of the time. So I thought he would have entered into it with that, not obviously entered into it with that knowledge, because he knows about this far better than I do. But maybe just I don't know. It was time for him to move on. I bet he's relieved. I bet he's so relieved that he's not there and having to do this anymore. And he knows, well, there'll be a chance again if he wants to come back. He'll be able to contribute again. The fact that he's still there as, you know, as on-screen talent means that he hasn't completely burned his bridge with the company. So there's always a way back. There was ways back in the times he was able to make comebacks back in the 2000s, and I'm sure he'll be able to in the 20s. if he chooses to do so. So
do you think with, because obviously with, I, you know, the rumor mill and from what people say, Heyman was a big proponent of young guys and girls on the roster. And
I mean, he always has been, hasn't he? That has always been his policy.
Always look towards the future, yeah, for sure. And he, you know, so people like the Street Profits or Drew or Cedric or Umberto Carrillo or Andrade, like you can see all these people that he wants to push, or Asuka.
Yeah.
Do you think, and I guess the argument that's been bandied around is maybe Vince decided he, you know, he wanted, you know, the ratings kept going down. He wanted, you know, he maybe Vince wants to go back to the well that has, you know, kept him safe over the years, whereas Heyman wants to look towards the future. Do you think that, do you think we are going to see the TV start to go back to old ways that they did before to try and make up for it? Or do you think Vince is going to stick with, you know, the Drew McIntyre push and stuff like that? Do you think we'll see a change in the TV with Heyman gone or not so much?
Probably not. I mean, a lot of the times when we've been watching this, you're asking yourself the question, so Paul Heyman's writing this, he's in charge of this, right? And then you know, you give yourself a shake and you're like, no, Paul Heyman isn't in charge of this. Vince is. Never forget that. Doesn't matter who's under Vince. Vince is still... So I don't know what really will change. I mean, we've seen a lot of wacky things on this program, both Raw and SmackDown this year, and certainly a backlash with the Street Viking Raiders. A cinematic experience. I mean, what an experience that was. So I'm not sure if anything really will change. But I mean, Heyman is absolutely right. And this has always been his motto. It's like, you know, the future, you need to push the young guys. And I look at WWE right now and you think, okay, there are quite a lot of new people in positions, but not at the top. And I just feel like they've got so many people in NXT or developmental and so many people that they could be doing more with. And I just don't feel like there's this real, you know, drive to create new big stars at the moment. It almost feels like everything's kind of on hold. I mean, obviously there's the Drew, but that started back in January with his Royal Rumble win. And they're sticking with that. And, you know, Lashley has received a bit of a push. And there are certain people that have. But I don't really feel like there's a big, you know, movement here to create a new wave of stars. I don't really feel like this has been rammed down our throats. You know, on one hand, maybe that's not a bad thing because, you know, sometimes when you just push too hard, people then rebel against it. You know, I think when you've got to push a new guy or a new female or whatever, whoever it is, it's got to be done in a way that people don't feel like we're being told you must like this person, kind of like what we've seen, and obviously with Roman Reigns as well. So I think you have to be more sophisticated in the way that you push people so that people are more inclined to accept and to rebel against them and feel that this person, you're being told, you must like this person. I think if it's more sort of natural and organic, it has a tendency to work better in the long run. But I mean, yeah, I look at WWE right now and how many people have they got in developmental? So many people they're waiting for. And I just feel like we should be seeing more of them. And I feel like they've got a lot of TV time and I think they could be doing more with it than they are. Young talent. You know, it's not like 1994, 1995 when they had no young talent. Now they've got so much. It's just outrageous. You know, let's see some of that. You know, that's what I want to see. You know, certainly Randy Orton's next feud, I want that to be with somebody younger. I want that to be with somebody that Orton is going to make into a star. Somebody that Orton is going to attempt to make into a star. I don't want to see, you know, him wrestling another veteran. I want to see somebody getting a chance with Orton. You know, they've done some. We'll talk about this a little later, I'm sure. They've done something pretty consequential, monumental with Orton, I think, over the last week. And I think they need to maximize Orton's renewed status as a star to create another star. So that's what I would like to see. And I bet that's what he's pushing for as well. So it's weird, you know, we look at WWE and the amount of talent they've recruited is incredible. But it's like a lot of them are just sort of stagnant and not really getting moved forward. Obviously, Karrion Kross being a big exception, but there isn't that many others that are really getting pushed, and that's what I'd like to see more of. What do you think, Kenny?
Yeah, I think that. I mean, I think sadly, given the promo on Raw Talk that Orton might be doing something with the Big Show next, but
oh my God.
But I mean, as long as that's just a TV match, fine. You know, beat him on TV, it doesn't matter. But yeah, I think once we're getting to like SummerSlam and stuff, and you want to see Orton putting over or working with somebody a lot younger and newer who he can do something with. But we have a ton of WWE shows to talk about, yes. And obviously we won't talk too much about SmackDown, but there are two things we need to talk about. The first being we saw the Intercontinental Title Tournament final with Daniel Bryan, AJ Styles, and AJ Styles got the win and became the new Intercontinental Champion. What did you make of the match? And, you know, does putting the belt on AJ, is that a good move for the title and for him after his move to SmackDown and losing Gallows and Anderson? And how did they do in terms of making it feel like a big match and making the belt feel like it means something again?
I thought they did a really good job. I mean, I thought the video and the significance of the Intercontinental title that was broadcast before the match, I felt that was, that felt like something that was broadcast to make us care, make us believe that this was something extraordinary. And I feel like Styles and Bryan went all out. I thought it was a very good match. I think it did just before the finish, because I think it's like nearly 35. It was about a 35-minute match, wasn't it, in total?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we saw about 26 of it without breaks. But yeah, the actual length was about 35.
Yeah, so I felt it did peak just before the finish. But I mean, overall, I mean, it's a match that really, really cemented how much this meant. It felt like another big drive here to make Intercontinental title, you know, to up the prestige of the Intercontinental title. And I think by putting these two guys, who are both ordinarily main eventers, who have held top title, putting them in the final, I think was a big statement from WWE and SmackDown. The statement being, these two guys are vying for this championship. They really want it because they know it's going to enhance themselves, or at least Daniel Bryan's going to use it to try and enhance others. But really big. I was expecting Bryan to win. I didn't think Styles was going to win it, but either way, it doesn't matter. The match was so good. It was so long. Bryan's a guy who could do a job. He could do a job every pay-per-view now and for the next year, and he would still be a star. I don't think it would really diminish him in any way. He's a guy who just, to me, seems so comfortable out there now. He just exudes confidence. Not arrogance, confidence. And there's something about Bryan right now where I really feel like he knows that he's been there 10 and a half years. He's actually more than that. He signed in September 2009, didn't he? So he's coming up 11 years this year that he's been part of the WWE machine. And he knows that he's made there. He knows that whatever happens, he's going to be all right. And he's a guy that I'm sure will do everything to try and make everyone around him better. So, and he absolutely did this here for AJ Styles. Styles has got the same attitude. I think it was important for him because obviously he lost to The Undertaker in the Boneyard match at WrestleMania. Then he missed out on the Money in the Bank briefcase to Otis and Money in the Bank. So I think Styles needed the win here more than Bryan in hindsight, even though I thought Bryan was the guy that was going to win it. I think really because he did he gave such an impassioned promo, you know, prior to the tournament final, you know, and set out his goals, his plans for what he was going to do with it if he were to win the title in the tournament final. So, I was really chuffed for the match. I thought it was really well done. I thought it was, full marks to WWE for the whole presentation of this, from the video beforehand to the length of the match, to, you know, really just putting Styles over and making him seem like a major star again. Not that I don't think he ever was really hammed by the Undertaker loss either. He's in a similar position to Bryan, that he's established now, so he can take those defeats. It doesn't really harm him at all. But I think this was an important win for him, and I'm excited to see what he's going to do with the title. What did you think, Kenny?
Yeah, I mean, I think the only thing, if I was being nitpicky to complain, because I did like the story and I thought the final felt big, is that for me, a sort of 35-minute match in front of some trainees is difficult to hold my attention for the whole time. Because I think when I'm watching wrestling, I think what I'm figuring out in this era is that the crowd are a big part of it for me and my enjoyment of it. So I feel like that was a small issue, but there's nothing they can do. You know, you mentioned earlier, like, a lot of stuff seems like it's on hold, and it probably is on hold because, you know, we're not seeing any pops for anybody. We're not getting a chance to see who's over to a certain degree or who's not. We're just kind of in this bubble where we have to exist for a while. So I thought they did the best of what they could. And I think you're right. I mean, even though AJ's 42, I think he is right now, he has had, you know, a few big losses and he needed a big win, and this was it. So I think on the whole, it ticked all the boxes.
Yeah, absolutely agree.
I will say that the wasp did go near the microphone there, so if you heard it, ladies and gentlemen, I did spend 30 minutes trying to get this fucker out of my room, and I can't do it. So, anyway, the other thing on SmackDown that is just, I don't even know how we approach this, but basically they did this segment with Sheamus and Jeff Hardy where, well, I mean, Finn, you had to delve into your mental castle, into your psyche, and you found that this was actually kind of a mirroring image of an angle from 14 years ago, right?
Yeah, March 13th, 2006 on Raw, segment involving Vince McMahon, Shane McMahon and Shawn Michaels, and, you know, insisted that Shawn Michaels provide a urine sample in a curtained off area of the ring. And then Shawn did that, you know, reluctantly, then had this massive red cup of what looked like urine. Then Vince is mocking Shawn Michaels, and then Shawn says, you know, sometimes it's better to be pissed off than pissed on, and then throws it on Vince and Shane, and they both sold it, but they just sold it in a totally clownish fashion, and it got a huge pop at the time. I mean, it was ridiculous, it was juvenile, it was Vince humour. 2AT, you know, this is Vince's humor, as people know, and it was a facsimile of that. And used the same language did Sheamus when they did the angle with Jeff Hardy at the beginning of SmackDown last Friday. So, you know, sometimes it's better to be pissed off than pissed on, and through the urine in Sheamus's face. I think then later the doctor confirmed that Jeff had tested negative for drugs and alcohol. So Sheamus did not have a good night, Kenny.
He did not. Now, if we were recording this podcast, I said, Finn,
Hang on, can I just stop there?
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah, of course. The doctor was there with the test paper in the urine sample before Jeff threw it in Sheamus. Of course. So he had actually done the test before it was hurled at Sheamus.
But I was going to say, if I was to say to you right now, Finn, I think you've got a drug and alcohol problem, so I'm going to need you to take a urine test right now with no notice. Could you put that much pee in a cup on the spot? I couldn't.
Well, I mean, I guess I could if I'd had like 5 or 6 pints first.
But surely he would be, you know, Jeff Hardy would have gone for a piss before he went out for his segment.
Well, you would have thought so. I mean, I get so nervous before I do this podcast. I have to go for one right before the podcast. I get so nervous. So it probably is true, actually, as a wrestler. They probably go before they go to the ring. So, yeah, I think it would be hard work. You know, but you're applying logic here, Kenny. This is WWE. And playing logic is dangerous sometimes. We all know that. We both know this. We all know this.
Do you think coming out of this segment on SmackDown, which obviously, you know, they're using real life history to tell a wrestling story, which has happened, you know, decades and decades and decades.
It happened in the Shawn Michaels segment as well, didn't it?
Yeah, it happened to Shawn Michaels.
In that whole feud where Vince was encouraging Shawn to regress to his bad old ways, and Shawn's saying, never, I'll never do that again. So he worked that in back in 2006, didn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, I guess maybe the reason why the Shawn one didn't feel as egregious is because Shawn's drug use, we are led to, well, I think that his problems stopped in about 2001, 2002, I think.
Yeah, I think probably around about then, maybe, certainly before he returned. But the thing was, none of us were as aware of it as we have been of Jeff Hardy's, because Shawn never had any high profile arrests during this period. As far as I know, he didn't have any arrests. So, I mean, I think it was more of a personal thing that people were aware of it. Certainly people in wrestling were aware of it, but I don't think the public was as aware of it as we are with Jeff.
And, you know, Jeff's had multiple arrests the last couple of years. Yeah. I guess my question to you, and this is us basically looking into a crystal ball and trying to make it up maybe, do you think that this kind of stuff is going to in any way sort of make Jeff make a judgment on what he's going to do next spring when he has a decision to make of where he's going to sign?
I don't know. I mean, I think it'll be forgotten by then. I mean, Jeff had the last laugh here. Obviously, Sheamus won the match at Backlash, but I don't doubt for a moment that that's going to lead to a rematch at Extreme Rules next month. And I feel confident predicting that Jeff will emerge victorious in whatever match they decide to have there. So I think in the end, Jeff is going to win this feud. And I think, you know, he's exonerated, if you look at it. I'm obviously, the doctor came and told Sheamus that Jeff had tested negative for drugs and alcohol. We know that he was not the one behind the wheel of the car that plowed into Elias. And by the way, at the start of SmackDown, one of the commentators said the investigation is still ongoing. So, I mean, Sheamus, we don't know what's going to happen there. Maybe they'll, you know, investigation still being ongoing, maybe that power will be just dropped next week.
Well, in saying that, I do need to bring up Jamie Miller, who we both know.
Yes.
He made a prediction, and I think he actually might be right here. He said, because if you look at it, on SmackDown the last couple of weeks, Sheamus has at no point said, I did it, right? He's never said he did it. He's made allusions to the fact that he thinks Jeff's a drunk, but he's never said he did it. Now, what the police were told is a man with red hair and a red beard.
Yes.
Who else has red hair and a red beard? The man who was stripped of the Intercontinental Championship, Sami Zayn.
Yes.
So could it be when Sami Zayn returns down the line, whenever that's going to be, that Sami will be revealed to be the perpetrator, you know, to railroad the Intercontinental title tournament?
Well, I mean, I suppose so. I mean, I think it does seem more likely that it was Sheamus. But I mean, yeah, that could be the outcome here. That could be the conclusion to all this.
Just call Jamie Jessica Fletcher. He'll sort that. I used to love watching Murder, She Wrote, and 50 police officers were outthought by an old woman who wrote a book.
Oh, she can't make it up. She knew it all. I mean, she was like, that was 1980s, wasn't it? Columbo
yeah.
was the 70s. I'm a big fan of the 70s Columbos. Can't watch the later ones, but I think the 70s ones are tremendous. In fact, I've seen all of them except for one, and I've got that on my Sky planner. And I'm just thinking, you know, I can't watch that last episode of Columbo from the 70s that I've never seen, because if I do, then there'll be no more to watch. That there is what you call delayed gratification.
Well,
something you probably know nothing about, Kenny.
I'm not getting into my delayed gratification on this podcast. although
Sami Zayn could be the culprit. I mean, that is possible.
Anything can happen in the World Wrestling Federation.
Of course, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Let's move on to Backlash on pay-per-view.
Hold on, can I just mention, was there anything else on there that did deserve a mention?
Sonya and Lacey did well, again. They deserve a little nod.
Yeah, I thought that Bayley and Sasha Banks, their celebration with stacks of balloons, I thought that was really funny. Alexa Bliss and Nikki Cross came out, then the Iconics appeared on the big screen. So that was pretty good. And then that led to Strowman, Otis and Tucker versus Morrison, Miz and Dolph Ziggler. Actually a bit of a non-event in the main event, wasn't it? In fact, that really sort of diminished my interest, if that was possible, in the Strowman versus Morrison and Miz match of Backlash. Because, you know, Otis ended up pinning Dolph. It was just like, we hadn't seen Dolph for ages. I mean, he was there obviously as the designated jobber. I mean, what the hell did that match do for Backlash? So I don't even know why I even brought that up, Kenny. So I apologise. I apologise to everyone for wasting 2 minutes of their time. Let's move on to Backlash.
I enjoy just listening to your mental thoughts for a couple of minutes. That's good. Well, obviously, you know, as always, everybody, you can listen to this podcast 24 hours earlier on Patreon, but also on Patreon, you can hear Sondra and I go through a full Backlash review. So I might be a little bit quieter during this part because we are here to hear what Finn has to say about Backlash, but it might open up some conversation points as well. But on Backlash, Apollo Crews beat Andrade for the US title. I said this on the Patreon review, I'll say it here. You know, Bayley's proved us wrong, right? Bayley really has proved us wrong in a lot of ways, and we're very happy that she's proved us wrong.
We're happy that we're wrong.
Yeah, she's sticking it to us. She's finally found the character that works for us, for her. Apollo Crews is just so dull, and I just don't see any character stuff there, and I just
I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, it's growing, it's blossoming. MVP is decided he's gonna try, gonna take Apollo Crews under his wing.
I hope he does, because that would make this, that would make it better. You know, if he had Apollo Crews, because he needs something. Smiley babyface, flippy Apollo Crews is just, it's a one way ticket to main event. You know,
it's just non entity in 2020, and has been for at least 10 years, maybe 20 years. I mean, that, you know, smiley babyface stuff worked in the 80s and I guess into the early 90s. It doesn't really work now. But I have faith. You know, I think MVP and Apollo Crews, I think there's some of there, Kenny. That's...
Well, again, I'd love to be proved wrong. I'd love to be proved wrong, so hopefully I am. But on the pay-per-view, we had the opening match with Sasha and Bayley defend the women's tag title, against the Iconics and Nikki Cross and Alexa Bliss. Fun promo pre-match for Kayla Braxton was trying to basically stir the pot. She was being a shit stirrer, was Kayla. But it didn't work because Sasha and Bayley still were able to retain the belts in the end. What did you make of the opener?
Well, Bayley wasn't having any of it. Sasha went to the ring first and Bayley put Kayla straight. She should have said to her, if you keep that up, another pot of paint is going to land on your head.
I'm here for it.
So, yeah, I mean, the Iconics, I mean, they come out, do the Charlie's Angels pose. There's a difference for you. And, you know, it all falls apart for the Iconics, doesn't it, really, once they've done their entrance and they've stopped speaking. You know, in this match, you could only tag in a member of your own team. So there's one member from each team in at one time. Started with Nikki versus Bayley versus Billy Kay. I mean, it's just like with Billy Kay, nothing flows. It's hesitation. It's clumsy. Nothing's natural. It all seems difficult for her. Like, this is something. It's like me doing a difficult chord change on the guitar. It just doesn't happen very smoothly. You know, it's like, at this point, Billy Kay should be better than this. And I thought this match was not far off amateur hour. I thought the Iconics really let it again. I thought some of it looked really bad, especially towards the end. There was a sequence there at the end with that just looked so bad. In the end, Bliss hit Twisted Bliss on Peyton Royce. But Banks dived in, and then she and Bliss, I think that's right, isn't it? She dived
yeah,
in.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Bayley and Banks retained the Women's Tag Team Championship. Not disappointing, really. Kind of predictable, because the Iconics shouldn't really be in at this level. To me, they're not a tag team caliber team. They're not getting any better. They're really good on the entrance, really good on the mic. I think they're tremendous. I think they both look great. I think they've got a lot of presence and charisma and work really together. I think the interaction between the two is tremendous, great chemistry. But in the ring, it just all falls down. So as far as the match went, I was glad when it ended, Kenny, if I'm honest with you. What did you think to it?
I thought it was fine. It didn't set the world on fire, but obviously, you know, taking the belts off Sasha and Bayley would have been a big mistake.
Sure.
So, you know, it was fine. It wasn't as good as the opener women's tag match at WrestleMania that we had. No. That was a little bit better, but I like Sasha and Bayley in the role, and you know, you could bring Luthes back from the dead and get a good match at Billy Kay. But
Bayley's match with Tamina Snuka at Money in the Bank was better than this.
Oh, yeah, definitely. 100%.
So, enough said.
Then we got Jeff Hardy versus Sheamus. This, for me, kind of suffered the same fate a little bit as the Brian AJ match, in that it was kind of a long match that felt like in front of a crowd, it would have been a lot more appetizing as a match. But Sheamus did get the big win, so, you know, at least they're... They're giving that to him. Maybe he's going to go on to face Strowman now. I don't know. Or maybe, like you said, they'll do a return at Extreme Rules. But what did you make to the Sheamus and Hardy match and Sheamus going over?
Yeah, I thought it was pretty good. I think it was the right outcome in order to prolong the feud. As I said earlier, I think it's going to Extreme Rules on July 19th in some gimmick match in which Jeff will score his big victory and have his, you know, redemption will finally be achieved. Sheamus put his foot on the bottom rope to thwart the Swanton, and then Sheamus won with the, I think he hit two broad kicks in succession. I know it was pretty good. I think it did last too long. Sheamus is a guy whose matches never really exceed a certain level. And I think same as well, except for when he's in a gimmick setting. And then he'll do some crazy things, or at least I think he still will do those crazy things. We don't know. We haven't seen those crazy do any crazy things for a while because obviously he was injured for ages. But I think these two were kind of holding back. This felt like a warm-up match for what's to come. But I mean, I think it did everything it set out to. I don't think they intended to go out there and all, firing on all four cylinders and give us everything they had. I think they're saving that for the next match. So yeah, I thought it was perfectly satisfactory for what they needed to achieve at Backlash.
And then we had Asuka and Nia Jax for the Raw Women's title, which ended up being kind of the beginning of something rather than a kind of blow-off match.
Yeah.
It went to a double count at the end. It was hard-hitting at points. My question to you is going to be, Nia Jax has received a lot of criticism recently over performances and injuries that have been caused to people she's worked with. Did this performance give her anything to kind of say, you know, look, here's why I'm here?
I deserve this. You know, this is not based on nepotism or anything like that. I'm here based on merit. No, it did not. Can I just say prior to this, Kayla revealed to Morrison and Miz that the winner of the fall in the handicap match with Braun Strowman would become champion if Morrison or Miz were to beat Strowman in the title match. Ha ha! As if they were to win.
Is Kayla Braxton just stating the fucking obvious?
Yeah, I mean, Kayla's like, she's got a bit of attitude, Kayla, hasn't she? You know,
she's fiery.
I mean, ever since that paint landed on her head, I think that was a turning point for her. I see big things for this woman in store. I see more of a role in WWE for her, and good for her. I think she's got a lot to offer. As for Asuka and Nia Jax, I mean, Nia's kind of tainted for me at the moment, just the whole Kairi stuff, and I'm really having a hard time with her. I think she's taken that criticism badly, and I think it's knocked her confidence. That's what I saw in this match.
Sandra made a really good point about, you know, she's come back from double knee surgery. She's not moving very well.
Mm. Yeah, I agree with that. She's not. Doesn't seem to be really confident in her movements. Seems like she's holding a lot back. She kind of reminds me, you know, Batista a couple of times in his career went through these runs where he's always injured, and you saw him in the ring and it was as if when he was in there, he was constantly paranoid that he was going to suffer another injury. So that was kind of affecting his performances and preventing him from doing things in the way he normally would. And I think, yeah, possibly the double knee surgery combined with all this flack that she's received over the Kairi Sane injuries, to me she doesn't really seem like she's out there and, you know, in full effect to me.
Nia Jax has had a couple of really, really great matches with smaller opponents, one with Asuka Takeover in 2016, a great match with Bayley at the London Takeover.
Yes.
And the was it the Money in the Bank match with Ronda?
Famous Ronda match, yeah.
So, you know, she's got this really good kind of Goliath element to her, you know, to go up against the David. But the problem is that she's actually getting worse rather than getting better. And that's a problem. And I know there's this kind of, you know, jokes of like, Nia should be sent to developmental. And look, I'm sure if you're Nia Jax, that's a real insult to have to be told that you need to do that. But I think if she wants to get to a point where she's going to be remembered as a sort of, you know, a legend in women's wrestling legitimately, then I think she needs to go and do some training, and she needs to go and do something else, because she had glimmers of really good stuff before. And a year ago, I would have said, get Becky Lynch and Nia Jax in the main event of a pay-per-view, and that would do well. But I don't think that would be the case now.
I think she's almost afraid that she may now hurt someone. And I think, you know, in wrestling, the confidence and you feel that self-assurance is so important. And you've got to feel like when you're executing your moves, you're executing him in a way that looks good, but he's not injuring your opponent. So I think she's really tentative right now, hesitant right now about doing things. And I think that really shone through here in this match with Asuka, who's a real sturdy competitor. I mean, she can take it. You know, she can take a few knocks. If Naya's a little bit rough or a little bit snug, Asuka can handle that. But to me, it just felt like Naya was, you know, very cautious in everything that she did. And that really slowed down her performance. And there wasn't really any kind of spark there or real energy or zest. You know, wasn't that sort of snap in her moves? And she doesn't somebody who's like this fearsome presence. She's like somebody who's afraid of hurting someone. And I absolutely understand that. And it must be a difficult thing as a wrestler when you've injured a few people and you start to doubt yourself. That must be really tough. You know, obviously we just sit here and talk about or whatever. You know, you do interviews. We're not the ones who are actually doing this. And that must be really tough to do that. And I can't imagine that too many people have got too much sympathy right now, sadly. I don't know what something needs to change. I'm not saying send her back to developmental, but I think she needs to regain her confidence because this match did not come across as, it just felt like I'm just glad it wasn't on any later in the show. This felt like a low card match. Asuka's matches recently with Charlotte Flair, and they felt like big matches. You know, they had a real aura to them. This did not. And you've got to really lay that at the door of Nia Jax. I think she had a really bad night. And then it was a double count out, Kenny. And which is a finish that no one in 20 wants to see, especially on a pay-per-view. So, I mean, this match was, it was a big thumbs down to me. You know, it just felt like, it almost felt like a warm-up match, like, as if they weren't really only doing about a quarter of what they were capable of under normal dances. But I mean, maybe now with Naya in this, you know, kind of depressed state that she's in as a performer, you know, maybe we can't really expect to her. There's a lot of people that don't have much sympathy for Nia Jax right now, and I understand that. But I mean, I think she's going through a moment in her career. And I hope she can find a way through this because I think, as you said, she's had some epic matches in this company. She's proven to be, you know, really, you know, valuable piece of this company, a valuable performer in the women's division. And obviously, we'd all like to see that again.
Yeah, for sure. So listen, we'll take the MVP and Lana and Lashley stuff to that match. But up next, we had Braun Strowman versus The Miz and Morrison in the handicap match for the Universal title. We got the music video beforehand of Hey, Hey, Hey. And then we got this match.
Did Braun kind of cut that off, didn't he?
He did, yeah. They were just about to get to the big crescendo and Braun came out. And Braun got the win here. I mean, this has got to be the most nothing Universal title match on pay-per-view or up there.
Absolute garbage. This is what can happen when you promote an act above its capability. Miz and Morrison, if you go back to Money in the Bank, they had a great match. That tag match at the start of the show. Mm-hmm. And they've been a fun act. You put them in a match with Braun Strowman and they look like buffoons. I mean, after it ended, the commentators were making fun of the match, making fun of the whole thing was like a clown show. I mean, Braun Strowman's is the Universal Champion. What's he doing wrestling in a comedy match on a pay-per-view? So I thought this was a total waste of Braun. And I think really detrimental to Miz and Morrison, who I think came out of this looking like a joke. You know, again, going back to Nia Jax, at one point being a very, very valuable and constructive part of the promotion. I mean, Miz and Morrison kind of need rehabilitating now after this. I think this is the worst thing on the show by a mile.
Yeah, it was garbage. It was just so forgettable. So let's just move on. Doesn't deserve any of our time. Yes. So we had the promo with MVP and Lana backstage before the Universal title match where basically, you know, she's annoyed that she's not being included and she wants to give MVP some advice, but he cuts it off and said that she should talk to her husband. But then he was like, you know, but you won't do that because you're scared to death of what he'd tell you. And he goes off smugly to manage Lashley for the title match with Drew. Pre-match, Lashley puts the full Nelson onto Drew. Big props to those two for selling the full Nelson and putting it over as a move that means something.
Yeah.
Which has not been the case for a long time.
Well, they can do that with any submission hold.
Yeah, but you just and they did it well here. And then so we had the Drew and Lashley match. It went about 13 minutes. Lana ended up coming out at the end, and she ended up becoming the fall for Lashley because she got in the apron. McIntyre ended up headbutting Lashley into her, and she fell off the apron onto MVP. McIntyre hit the Claymore kick and got the win. Lashley was pretty annoyed afterwards. How did this match do for you? It's another big win for Drew. Did it enhance Lashley? What did you make of it?
Yeah, I mean, just shows, Kenny, that, you know, when Lana turns up, bad things happen. I mean, you've been saying that for years.
Listen to me, folks. I'm like the person that was, I'm like the people 5 years ago going, we need to be prepared in case of the pandemic. I told you years ago that she was shite.
Listen to Kenny and you won't go far wrong. That's what I always say.
Only for Lana-related advice.
So, I thought it was a match that, again, was a match that was designed to set up a rematch. That's a lot of the content of the show seemed like it was like warm-up matches or matches that were part of a story rather than the end of the story. Except, of course, with Strowman and Miz and Morrison. I think that was the end of the story, at least. It was. Some of this looked a bit dodgy. There's like this really dodgy looking throw at ringside. Lashley ended up throwing Drew and he ended up having like a forward roll on landing. And you see, Lashley was checking to make sure that Drew was okay. That could look really bad. They brought that up on commentary. Sojo amused me when he was on commentary when he said, they love it when a plan comes together, when Lashley and MVP had conspired to take down. You know, a reference there to the A-Team, of course, Kenny. Another dated reference there. This podcast's full of dated references this week.
I mean, you've got to also give Samoa Joe credit for the, when they came back from, I think it was here, not on Raw, when they came back from the AJ interview and Samoa Joe said he hopes that AJ's at home enjoying time with his family and smiled at camera. Great.
Actually, well, yeah, there was a Styles promo there and he actually wrote this down. Styles said, I live in the real world, my world. You know what I mean? They're just
the flat Earth world. That's it. It's funny. I bought my other half, Steve Gunn, a globe for his a drinks globe for his birthday. It came round. It wasn't a flat one, so we're gonna send it back.
I bet AJ doesn't have one of those in his living room.
None of that fictitious bullshit.
So, I mean, Lashley applied the ankle lock, Drew applied the Kimura lock, Lashley countered a claymore with a spear, Drew McIntyre kicked out. Then, as you said, Lana came out to distract Lashley. You know, he was, well, not intentionally, she came out and the upshot was that Lashley was distracted, so he was taken off his game. And then we had the little collision on the ring apron there, and Drew hit the claymore for the pin. Lana's on the ground. Lashley walks off in disgust. Felt to me like a match that was designed to give Drew the win while protecting Lashley and giving him a motivation or justification to demand a rematch at Extreme Rules, which I think will be the case. I think that's the way it's going to go. So again, it was a match that was not the end of a feud, and therefore they didn't go all out. They didn't give us everything that they had in their arsenals. So I think there's more to come from these two. But I enjoyed it. It wasn't a blowaway match. This felt very much felt like a show which was just designed to keep things simmering. You know, it wasn't like they were turning the temperature up on the cooker to 9. It was on like 4 or 5 most of the night. I think we had an analogy last week, didn't we, about something being on the back burner, simmering, Kenny? Yep. I think we did, yeah.
Let's keep our oven puns going. This was an omelette-based event, given the heat levels. But anyway, then we had the weirdest...
omelette-based event.
The weirdest thing on this show, we had the Street Profits and the Viking Raiders doing more of their kind of... they were fighting backstage, they were fighting all around, they had a lot of kind of flashbacks and elements of their previous, you know, bowling challenge tournaments and shields and all that kind of stuff. But it all kind of got insane when the four of them are all kind of, you know, trying to stop fighting each other, when I guess seven motorcycles turned up with ninjas.
Yeah.
And the lead ninja is raw jobber Akira Tozawa. And he has a giant with him who's a ninja, who apparently is the Nigerian PC performer, Jordan somebody. And basically, the Street Profits and the Viking Raiders end up running onto the top of a truck, jumping off of it into a dumpster, and then the tentacle of a creature reached out as they all tried to get away. The thing that I think is the big difference between the Stadium Stampede match and this is the Stadium Stampede match was equally as bonkers as this, but most of the stuff that they did in that match was a continuity reference or a reference to something that characters have done before. You know, like Matt Hardy putting Santana and Ortiz into the Lake of Reincarnation, essentially, with the pool. Or whatever, all the things that you've seen those characters do before. This all just seemed like, let's just do weird stuff and hope that it's good. And it didn't seem to have any purpose. And I think that's what, I mean, I wasn't bored, but I still don't really understand what I watched.
No, I mean, it was very, definitely very strange. At the end, yeah, they're lying in the dumpster, and then this bizarre, huge sort of tentacle from this creature. And that was obviously, like, came towards them, and they fled. And that was like a nod to the original Star Wars, wasn't it? You know, when they're all there in the rubbish area in the original Star Wars movie. Kenny, you've seen it, yeah?
And I've never seen Star Wars.
You know, well, I'm sure it was, because they're all there in this sort of trash area, and then there's this weird creature that lives in there. And that's what it seemed like to me. It had to be. It had to be a reference to Star Wars. Another dated reference. When did that come out? Was it 77 or 78 or something like that? So it was like, at various points in this, they're having flashbacks to their bowling challenge, you know, and previous challenges that they've had on Raw, and they're crashing through like windows and fighting round into the car park of the performance center, as you say. Then we had almost these references to these, you know, 1980s straight to video, you know, karate or ninja movies, like with Cynthia Rothrock. On its dated reference, City This Week, or what's that other fellow? Is it Shokasugi? I was a big fan of these movies back in the 80s. You know, and they were just terrible. Even when I was like 16, I knew these films were garbage. But I mean, you watch them because, hey, you're 15 or 16, and back in those days, there was no internet, so you just, you know, there's four channels, and hell, if you got a video out from the video shop and it was crap, you're going to watch it to the end, because what the hell else were you going to do? So it's not like now. It was just bizarre, this series of sort of skits that didn't really seem to have any connection. You know, it didn't exactly firstly, and there was all these sort of bizarre references to characters or events that weren't part of their feud. And they had lots to work with. They had lots to work with here. I mean, and obviously with the flashbacks, that had a link to doing here. But they introduced so many bizarre and irrelevant and just things that had no connection with this feud, that you were left wondering, what the hell is it that I'm watching here? Such a mishmash of like a confused mix of skits, just all sort of like rammed together with no connecting real thread. And then at the end, they were in the, as you said, in this dumb, and then this big great creature appeared, and then they fled, and that was it. That was the end of it. They went back to the commentators, and I'm thinking, is there going to be an actual to this cinematic experience? And there wasn't. So I didn't really know what to make of it, Kenny. It's like, you know, down this cinematic avenue. I mean, I'm a fan of it. I think what they've done prior to this mostly was very entertaining, but it just seems to me now lazy, and they're just saying, right, anything goes. You know, it doesn't have to have a reason to exist in this feud. It's supposed to be less. So whether or not it's based on anything that's happened previously or anything that can be explained, well, you know, those aren't the rules here, right? There is no logic anymore. You know, there are, because obviously wrestling's got its own internal logic, just as every TV program or comic strip or anything has. Seemed like to me like it massively deviated from that. Even the cinematic, you know, where we're at now with our cinematic rules, there's still an internal to it, isn't there, Kenny? There's still things that it has to satisfy. Like if you go back to Money in the Bank and the match that was took place in WWE HQ, pretty much everything that was in there was set up by something that had happened previously, or was feasible within the parameters of that world that they created, wasn't it?
But even if you look at a more out there one, the Firefly Funhouse match, the reason that worked was because you were basically doing this kind of weird look through John Cena's career. So you kind of were able to make sense of what Bray Wyatt or The Fiend was trying to do by taking John Cena into, you know, kind of like Freddy Krueger taking the kids into the dream sequence. Yeah. You got what it was. The problem with this was you just didn't really understand what it was. And it's like, you can do kind of lowbrow garbage type stuff in wrestling. I'll give an example. WrestleMania 9, you have Giant Gonzalez and The Undertaker, and Gonzalez can't take The Undertaker down, so he puts the chloroform on his face.
Yeah.
But the reason that The Undertaker is able to get back from it is because he's a dead man. So he rises from what a usual person would get up from. So even in the shitness of that match, there's a logic to what they were trying to put over. And I just don't think there was any logic here. And if I'm saying that the Giant Gonzalez and Undertaker is more highbrow, you're seeing an issue with this thing.
Yeah, it just seems to me that all the rules just went out the window here, and it was almost like, well, actually they needed to sort of rein it in here. And I think what they needed to do with the Street Profits and the Viking Raiders, they needed to really make this match newest than what we'd seen previously, because it was a pay-per-view. And in most respects, it just became more outrageous and nonsensical. The ending was like, I think the announcers watching it were just embarrassed by it. And I think they just thought, I bet they thought, my God, I'm glad that's over. And I'm just pleased that we can move on to something else.
Well, let's move on to something else, Finn.
Let's do that.
So the main event of Backlash was obviously the greatest match ever, Edge and Orton. It went 45 minutes. They put a lot of bells and whistles onto it with Charles Robinson dressed as the old school ref, Howard Finkel doing the ring announcement, which I was kind of really touched by, to be honest, which I didn't really expect to be, but I, you know, Fink just means something, I think, if you're a WWE fan or WWF fan, that like when you hear his voice, it just adds a gravitas to it. And you've the MSG mic. What did you make of the match? Because they worked very hard, and they tried their best to try and live up to this kind of impossible moniker that it was given. Edge injured himself in the match, got a torn tricep, he's out for a while. What do you make of what they did? Was there anything more they could have done to kind of try and live up to what the moniker of the name was? Or was the moniker just a way to kind of make this be something that people remember more?
I mean, they said, yeah, there was amplified. You know, as you say, Howard Finkel did the intros. We had like ref. The camera was really close to them as the ref gave the instructions, like it was in a boxing match, MMA fight. I don't know, really. I mean, it lasted nearly 45 minutes. They used a lot of different camera angles, used a lot of canned heat to make it appear that the audience was really into it, and the audience who were there were into it, because of course they were into it. They're into everything because the beard appear. It was again, a Herculean effort by both. This reminded me a little bit of some of those Ciampa and Gargano matches where they sort of did everything. And they did everything and a little bit more, because then they start using each other's moves on the other. And because they know each other so well, they can anticipate what the other person's going to do before he does it. So then that leads to another counter, and that amps up the tension and makes it seem like more of a struggle with them. It's a match with that's steeped in history, and what they're doing is they're using the history to enhance the present. So that's absolutely what they did here. Like Edge used the Unprettier, didn't he, for a near fall, which was a tie-in with Christian giving him the pep talk on Raw. Loads of kickouts. In the end, Orton had used the RKO more than once, and Edge had kicked out. And in the end, he had to use the deadliest weapon in his arsenal, which was the punt, in order to score the pin. Both looked like they'd been through a war at the end. So I think it achieved everything that they wanted it to do in terms of making it seem like a real struggle, like a match that was like a proper sort of, you know, old style blood feud of two guys that really disliked each other and had something to prove out there, and that winning was everything. You know, winning was so important to both competitors. So in a way, it was kind of like an old school match, the way it was all worked and set up. I think it was quite a lot of New Japan elements in there as well, with them using each other's finish, each other's moves on the other. So, it was well done. I just thought it lasted too long, Kenny. And the whole marketing campaign with being told that it was going to be the greatest match ever before the match took place. It was so contrived and manufactured, obviously. And I think when a company sort of tells you how you're supposed to respond and how you're supposed to think, I think we're more inclined to find fault with it and rebel against the instructions disseminated by the company. Going into it, I really think they were hamstrung by the promotional campaign rather than enriched by it. That's my take on it. And I feel for them because the effort they put into this was, and I think had this taken place before an audience, I think it would have been remembered differently to how it will be. But I think it was still an amazing achievement by them. But they were impeded by a lot of what WWE did. And, you know, I always say the booking department should be there to enhance everything, not what you do, not to obstruct or handicap or impede it. You know, I just feel like these guys were kind of let down by the company with the way in which this was presented. There's no way it could be the greatest wrestling match ever. Going to be, but I think it was still very good. It lasted too long. I think if it had been 30 minutes, I think I would have enjoyed it more than I did. But again, like with Gargano and Ciampa, those matches lasted too long. You couldn't fault the work that went into them. But they were just out there for too long. And it really, in the final analysis, when matches last this long, they kind of feel a little bit self-indulgent. That's my view of it.
Do you think that they went as long as they did because they felt that with the moniker, they had to kind of try and make it feel, you know, because if they were just going in having a match and there was no moniker of the greatest match ever, they could have had a great 20-minute match and that would have been it. But they really stretched it out. They added all these different finishers. They were trying to add all this stuff in, kind of to make it live up in some ways to the hype.
Yeah, so yeah, almost like they're saying, right, we're sitting out masterpiece and we need 45 minutes to do it in. And I would argue that it would have been better had it been 30 minutes. You know, it's like watching some films that last 3 hours. I mean, how many films that are 3 hours would be better if they were 2.5 or 2? You know, there's probably a lot of films that are really good films that last 2. I just think, like, you know, and if they were, you know, shorter, then they would be, you know, seen as, you know, sharper and the editing would be better and they'd be more memorable and they wouldn't sag and there wouldn't be these parts of it which just sort of dragged on. And for me, that was the thing with this match. It's like, right, we need all this time. We need 45 minutes because it's going to be, you know, this outstanding achievement, this match for the ages. And I think, yeah, 30 minutes would have been ample time for them to tell the same story and to do it in a more engaging way. Without really testing our patience as they did here by going nearly 45 minutes. It was too long. Full marks again to the effort that went into it. I think the story was very well told. And I think these two really showed that they are top of the line pros. And there's not a lot of people, I think, in WWE that could have put a match together to this level with this amount of depth to it. a lot of people say, oh, pro, you know, a lot of pro wrestling is superficial. And I feel like this match had a hell of a lot of depth to it, but they were just out there too damn long.
They were indeed.
You know, and as I said, they were put in a position that was impossible, really, with the company saying, this is the greatest, this is going to be the greatest match ever. When, you know, and you're almost told, well, is it really going to be the greatest match ever? So you've told me that I need to think that it's the greatest match ever. So you're going to be more inclined to sort of disagree with them and say, well, actually, it wasn't. And in fact, AJ Styles versus Daniel Bryan on SmackDown was better. I mean, I don't know whether it was. It probably wasn't. But it was, to me, it was at least as good. And that probably lasted too long as well.
Well, listen, that's kind of where we are in Backlash. We're going to go over to the Overrun and cover Raw and issue 136 of Power Slam. So that's it for us here in the main podcast. I think next week what we'll do, maybe a couple on here and a couple on the Overrun, we'll take some questions from everybody, because I know we've not done that in a little while.
Yes.
So we should take some questions from the listeners. But Finn, before we leave here in the main podcast, do you have any plugs for everybody?
I just did another What's Going Down for Inside the Ropes that went up late last week. I think it did, Kenny.
It did, yeah. Really fun stuff. Talked about Kenny Omega and AEW, some Impact stuff. I think somebody commented in the comments to it, Finn isn't holding back. So it's always a good time to read extra stuff that you've not got to cover on the podcast.
Absolutely, yeah. So I hope you'll check that out. Yeah, it's I enjoyed writing that. Hopefully people will enjoy reading it as well.
Exactly, yeah. And you can, as I say, patreon.com/insidetheropes, where you can get that. This podcast 24 hours early, we do an Overrun where you can listen to us talk about Raw. You can listen to us talk about issue 136 of Power Slam with Brock Lesnar on the cover from 2005 when he was in New Japan, and much more.
That's right. Brock Lesnar's third appearance on the cover of Power Slam that year.
We will talk more about that on the Overrun. So we hope you'll join us over there. Thank you for all your support, everybody, and we'll talk to you soon. If I be tonight, if I'm sad tonight.